My guest in this episode is Hong Kong-based Jessica Seah. Jessica has a Bachelor of Communications, PR and Journalism from Australia, and a Law and Management Diploma from Singapore. She began her legal career as a legal journalist in Sydney before moving to Hong Kong, where she joined American Lawyer, and then Herbert Smith Freehills as a communications manager focused on media relations. This was the start of her in-house legal communications career, and during the next 7 years, she held similar roles with K&L Gates and Norton Rose Fulbright. The latter also took her to London. In 2021, she returned to Hong Kong and back to journalism as the editor of Law.com, where she researches and writes feature columns and news on the legal sector in Asia. She often breaks the story ahead of other major news outlets, and her articles are widely circulated in law firm boardrooms around the world. Often opinionated, always respectful, she undoubtedly has the most up-to-date knowledge of the Asian legal market, and I'm hoping she'll share these insights as well as any advice she can give to in-house communications professionals on working with the media. Welcome to the podcast, Jessica.
Hi, Graham. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. So I'm going to dive straight in with a question about why you chose journalism. Why did you want to be a journalist?
It's a funny story, really, because I mean, as you pointed out, I did a legal diploma in Singapore, and as part of that diploma, I had to do a few internships in law firms in Singapore. And that really scared me away from pursuing law permanently as a role. You know, I was doing mostly like sort of conveyancing stuff, insurance work, and immigration files. And so, you know, that was sort of my experience with practicing in a law firm as far as that goes. And I decided that that wasn't the way for me. So the next way was to sort of look at what I want to do and where I want to go. And I really had no idea, right? And I knew, the only thing I knew was that I loved to write. And so journalism became an option. And so I moved, went to Australia, studied journalism, and it was a double major in public relations as well, just in case I don't make it out as a journalist. So I did a double major and went ahead to look for a job. And to be honest, I first looked at jobs in PR in Sydney in public relations and quickly learned that no one's going to hire a foreigner to do public relations in Australia at that time. Because you know nothing about the culture, you know nothing about the products, and how are you able to market Australia to Australians if you know nothing about it? At that time, there were no roles sort of out there for that. I was desperate to stay in Australia though. So the job came up for journalism in the legal industry, covering the legal market, and required me to speak Chinese. And so I was like, tick, 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 right? Journalism, legal, a bit of legal background, can speak Chinese. And I went for it. Mm-hmm. At that time, I remember having $4 in my account left because I was so adamant to tell my parents, I have to stay here, I can make it, or they were going to ship me back to Singapore. And the day that I realized that, you know, gosh, this is my last go, $4 left in the account, got to go home soon, I received the offer to start as a legal journalist. And so
that's amazing.
And so that's how we started. And I remember I lived in Sydney near King's Cross, actually, and I was always sort of doing some freelancing work in this cafe that became my second home. It was run by a Greek family. And when I told them that I got a job, got an offer, when I found out I was in the cafe, and they, you know, opened champagne bottles, caught the whole family, everyone came, and, you know, we had a big party, and that sticks with me.
That's amazing, because when you think about it, you'd already embarked on one sort of career journey. So you'd studied law, you'd started that career in law, then taking the very brave step to re-qualify. I mean, did you feel at that time that you'd lost your way or that you'd lost time? You know, did you feel you'd lost momentum in your career? How were you feeling when you had to make the decision to leave the law and start studying something else?
I wasn't qualified to be a lawyer. It was sort of, it's a diploma, and the next step was to decide if I were to go to uni, was I going to pursue law?
Right. Yeah.
So the work that I was doing at the local law firms was really more paralegal type work.
Yeah.
And it was internship, so it was only 4 months, but it was enough to sort of scare me off, like, you know, that I don't want this to be my life.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I chose law because I think my parents wanted me to have a more, I guess, a professional qualification.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they had thought that, you know, I have a love for language, and that was probably the way for me to go. And it was very driven by not just my interests or my love for language, and also what my parents sort of wanted. But leaving at least the practice of law, the idea of practicing law, was an easy decision for me.
Yeah. Is it a decision that you're happy with now that you've got this lens of the legal profession, you know, fast forward to where you are now?
Absolutely.
You're still happy that you're not an M&A lawyer in New York across that boardroom table doing the deals?
I always say this when I interview, when I speak with lawyers, I'm not a lawyer, thank goodness. So yes, I'm super happy with my decision of not sticking with law, yeah.
All right. So you've seen both sides of communication. So you American lawyer, then you went in-house in law firms for 7 years. Mm-hmm. Now you're back as the editor of law.com. I'm curious to know, how did being in-house inform your journalism career? Like, what did you learn in-house that you use in practice today as a journalist?
It's an interesting question, because I think the key thing now that I've come back to write for Law.com International covering Asia is that I understand really the pain points in terms of working in law firms now. So when a media professional or business development professional is telling me, look, I can't get you this, or if they're avoiding me, or they're not picking up my calls, or they are, you know, choosing to respond in some way that isn't very resolute, I can sort of guess, I suppose, what the pain points might be, where the pressure, what types of pressure they're facing internally. When a firm is, you know, unwilling to confirm or deny a certain thing that's happening, you can sort of understand, okay, you know, from being in-house, if they were to confirm, these are the repercussions, and if they were to deny, these are the potential repercussions. So I have a much better view of that now. And also, sort of having been in-house, I know sort of how to ask more pointed questions, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
So you won't necessarily, you know, even right down to, okay, a transactional lawyer versus a capital markets lawyer versus an M&A lawyer, I really know the difference now.
Yes.
To be able to see, you know, how firms or how business development professionals are playing with words and sort of understanding that. Yeah, so I think, you know, there are a lot of things that I think I've seen in-house, and the politics between partners as well, when, you know, the politics that a business development professional will need to deal with, and me sort of sitting on the other side and understanding the pressures that they face and mm-hmm. trying to find sort of a middle ground
mm-hmm.
that we can work out, you know, what I get, what I need, and also you're not going to get in real trouble
mm-hmm.
with providing me with what I need.
Mm-hmm. The other part of that question is, did you find having been a journalist before you went in-house, was that helpful?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, and I can say this, you know, like certainly like when going from journalist to in-house, I think everyone sort of thinks that that's, I guess, a natural next step if you're not going to stick with journalism. I went from journalism, I can say it was Herbert Smith Freehills I joined, and I was, you know, very fresh junior journalist at that time, joined as a PR and communications manager. And within basically 2 weeks, I was told by someone who no longer works at the firm, and, you know, the firm is an entirely different place now as well, I was told to tone down in that I was asking too many questions,
right?
You know, and they're not used to being asked all these questions. It was very much like, okay, the partner wants to do this. Let's see how we can help them make it work. But I was asking sort of, you know, I always apply in everything I do the so what test. So what? But why do you want to do this? But when you say this, do you really know, you know, how that compares with something else? And you know what I mean? So I was asking too many questions and it made people uncomfortable. So I guess, you know, there's that too. But
aren't you still asking too many questions and making people uncomfortable? Isn't that just part of your career journey?
Yeah, but I'm not in-house now, so I don't have to suffer the wrath of it, yeah, I suppose.
Do you think that the role of PR media comms in law has changed over the last decade? And if so, how do you think it's changed?
Drastically changed. I think there's still a handful of PR and media communications managers and heads of around from, you know, 10, 15 years ago that I've dealt with back then, and they're still around. And my approach in communications with them very much the same. Our expectations are there, you know, how you would deal with Jess and how I would deal with, you know, these PR managers. But I think that obviously with every year comes new blood and a new generation of advisors. I think because of how instantaneous things are and how digital things have become, the connection and those relationships have dissipated some.
Right.
People prefer sending emails, you know, back and forth for a full day.
Right.
Whereas, you know, my preference is picking up the phone, sitting down, having a conversation. And we can come to an understanding of what the middle ground looks like. But it's a lot less transparent. It's a lot less candid. And there's a trust issue here, right? So, you know, in first, particularly reading the stories that I write, I suppose there is a little bit of anxiety or nervousness when it comes to dealing with journalists who dig a little bit deeper. But I always say, look, I'm always up for a conversation. You know, I never turn down anyone and say, no, I don't want to sit down with you. And I think that really helps build the relationship and understand how things work. And I think there's definitely a lack of that in Asia as the years go by, I think.
I mean, it's interesting from my side looking in, there hasn't been the sort of explosion of media comms roles in the legal profession that I would have expected, given how many channels there now are for stories. You know, there's been a proliferation of ways in which stories can get out into the general ether, whether it's through LinkedIn, whether it's through, you know, social media, the different news channels and different magazines and publications that are now online only, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't seem to have made a huge impact on the number of people working in-house that specifically focus on media. We get quite a lot of people who are communications where media is part of their role. And I have a question which is really around, if you are a comms manager where media is only part of your role and a big story starts to come your way, which is about the business that you're working in, and for the first time you have to speak to a journalist like yourself, I can understand why there might be a nervousness because they haven't got as much experience and they might worry that everything they say to you is potentially going to be put in print. How would you allay the fears of somebody who maybe isn't as experienced working with journalists, that they can actually just pick up the phone and have a scoping conversation with you to find? I mean, how would you go about sort of getting them to understand that it's safe to do that, I suppose?
Well, there are quite a few BD heads, I think, in Asia who will say that I have been quite open in terms of, yes, I understand, you know, the partners are uncomfortable with dealing with the journalists, and I'm very happy to sit down with them and have a conversation. It's completely off the record. I always tell people most of my conversations are off the record. It's how I build trust. It's how I build, you know, my little circle of trust. Also, sources know that they can speak to me freely and not be quoted if they don't want to. They can give me background information. And that all helps with the breaking news and scoops, right? That's what Law Reform International is all about. We are not into rewriting press releases. We want to be first to market in law firm speak, you know. But, you know, there will be BD heads and there will be PR and media comms managers will come and say, hey, you know, there's this partner who we think is very interesting and we think that has a lot to, that this person has a lot to bring to the table, a lot to contribute, but it's not very media savvy. Are you happy to meet? There is not one time that I've said no.
Right.
I say that hand on heart. There is not one time that I've said no. I always say I'm happy to meet them, happy to have a conversation. And it's sort of get them to sort of to get them to know me, but also for me to know them. And frankly, in that conversation, I will know, is this someone I ever want to speak to again? Is this someone who is going to be helpful? Mm-hmm. Has the PR manager made a wrong recommendation? And if they have, I will tell the PR manager. I was like, okay, this is probably not the best person that I need to be speaking to. And yeah, again, it's that frank conversation. It's not sort of throwing anyone under the bus. It's having a really put everything on the table and say, okay, this is what it is. Can we work something out?
I'll take a deep dive here to reflect on what we've heard so far. Firstly, I think it's interesting and unusual to see someone move from journalism to in-house and then back out again. But it's clear that her time working in law firms has served her well. She fundamentally understands the politics and pressures that impact in-house roles, and this makes her open and willing to take time to build the trust she needs. I also liked her story of how, when she was in-house, she was told to tone it down and that she asked too many questions. This is also worth reflecting on if media management is not 100% of your role. Perhaps ask more of the so what questions, but be aware that media relations is not a comfortable place for most lawyers, but a necessary part of building a profile and managing reputation.
Hi, I'm Katie Rosser, co-founder of Seldon Rosser. And we are passionate about helping people maximise the return on their own career investment. Visit seldonrosser.com to see a range of career opportunities and access career guides and market information, such as salary surveys and articles. Our career goal is to help you get your next great job and make your own big splash in the world of work.
I'm really interested to know what your view is on the effectiveness of communications, particularly in relation to media, as an effective marketing and BD strategy.
Honestly, I think communications, marketing, business development is almost, when the market's not good, the first group to get the X. And it makes no sense to me.
Right.
When the market isn't good, you definitely need someone to deal with the media and talking to the media.
Yeah.
About what the situation is with the firm in terms of whether or not the firm is doing well or not. And I know a lot of firms take the approach of, okay, we just don't talk. If the market's not good, there's nothing to talk about.
Yeah.
But then it's just you basically have a comms manager that's just sitting there pumping out press releases when you have deals and happening. So what happens when there's no deals and people are still and journalists are still knocking on your door?
Yeah,
the investment needs to be a long-term investment in terms of what communications look like and training the right spokespeople and the successes coming up in dealing with difficult conversations and also good conversations.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some really good examples, which, you know, I won't name the firms, where firms have been caught on the back foot when journalists come knocking on the door or journalists are digging. And you know, what always happens is when I knock on the door and they're not ready, they send me to someone in the US or a media person in the US because they don't have dedicated headcount on the ground, or someone send me to someone in the UK who don't necessarily know the ins and outs of the Asia practice. And that actually really does them a disservice.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting because I would imagine you get quite a lot of press releases about offices that they're opening, but do you ever get press releases about offices that they're closing?
No, of course not. But you know, they will kind of write about it in a different way, you know, and that's why I say the in-house experience that I've had has been handy, right? When firms are trying to sort of shape the messages a little bit, but really essentially they're saying, you know, we no longer have presence on the ground. And I understand that, but then the risk that you're running is that you're pulling wool over the eyes of the journals, and they're not going to be happy treated as if they don't know the industry or they don't know the market. Mm. Yeah, so, you know, there needs to be communications when the times are good as well as when the times are bad.
Where do you think it's good in terms of, you know, putting your in-house hat back on of when you've worked in more generalist BD marketing roles? What advice would you give to a generalist marketer about how to use communications effectively as a business development tool?
My first piece of advice is don't spread yourself too thin.
Right.
I think I've had that experience whereby you are then delivering just, you know, a 50% of your capabilities to each area, you know, be it directories and awards or PR, media relations, general marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. I think it all should be tied together, really. Mm. Then it's not a siloed project at all, right? So if an objective, if there's a plan that's come down or a campaign that's come down from partners or the firm more generally saying, okay, this is what we're trying to achieve, or this is the issue that we're dealing with, absolutely all pieces should come in. And the piece that ties all of it together is communications, right? No. If you are sort of prospecting and you're targeting a specific client, your communications need to change internally. It needs to change externally to be speaking to the prospective clients you're looking for, right? Mm. But also when the times are not good and, you know, clients have been lost or firms have decided to close down certain practice areas or certain teams, again, the thing that ties everything together is comms.
Yeah.
Comms to partners, comms externally, comms to clients. And that's the piece that really pulls all the different areas together, you know, be it HR, be it operations, be it business development, be it marketing, campaigns, awards, and all of that.
Yeah. You mentioned directories. I'm almost nervous to go here with this question. But quite often, I mean, directory seems to be very nuanced to the legal sector, the legal directories, and often it falls within the job description remit of the comms department. What's your view on the effectiveness, really, of legal directories? Do they still have a place in the world today?
Ooh, you're asking me a tricky question, putting me on the spot here.
Of course.
I think the legal directories business has evolved so greatly that it's hard to pinpoint which part you're really asking about, right? Are you talking about straight rankings of partners and lawyers and teams and firms in different jurisdictions? Are you talking about now, you know, some of them are ranking business development professionals, mm-hmm. and some of them are ranking in-house counsel and general counsel, and then you have conferences everywhere. Mm. And, you know, and I did directories when I was in-house. Mm-hmm. It was the bane of my existence, and I will say that. I've said that before, and I'll say mm-hmm. it again. Mm-hmm. The thing about it is also the partners need to want help from comms and marketing to really draft a very incisive, sharp, and aligned submission. Then again, you also need to be very selective of what you're going for. Does all of legal directories have a place? You know, is all of it sort of appreciative for law firms? Frankly, I don't think so. Mm. But it's really looking at what are the pieces that works for your firm and your practice. As a new firm, a burgeoning firm or growing firm, you might want to look at legal directories as part of the marketing, as part of the branding. But if you're already established, you know, do your 60-year-old super senior partner care about or need to be ranked 3, 4, 5 or number one even on rankings? I mean, different firms are at different places, and it will play to different parts of that, I think.
It's a good answer to a complicated and complex issue facing quite a lot of marketers in law firms particularly. You've talked about the legal sector in Asia, which is what your focus is, and the fact that it seems to be a downturn market. What's changed? What's the reason for that, do you think? And the second part to this question, what do you think is going to happen next for law firms in Asia?
It's a big question. I think what's going to happen for law firms next in Asia, I think in different jurisdictions, there are different ways to play. I think in Greater China, foreign law firms really need to look at what structure they're going to employ and what size they need to be in Greater China. They need to look at the increasing risks that they face on the ground and be able to play to that in a way that's also sensitive to the people that they hire on the ground. Southeast Asia, again, is a different market, is already very saturated. There's room to play, I suppose, for firms like venture capital, because there are not a lot of established venture capital practices on the ground. You're increasingly seeing very established partners leave established international law firms to set up their own shop. in dispute resolution, international arbitration in particular, and I think that there's room to play in that. But for a lot of the big law players, you're really competing with very established law firms on the ground. So a lot of them, you know, in building their practice, is a race to the bottom. So you really need to think about, at the end of the day, it's a business. Firms need to be profitable. And, you know, being in Singapore, you need to look at the margins and the type of firms that you're competing against, right? Is it feasible? And is it aligned to your global objective and profitability? Japan and South Korea are sort of a different market. And they're not, I think for Japan in particular, it's been sewn up by a very small handful of international law firms for a very long time. To go into Japan, I almost feel like you definitely need to have synergies with your other jurisdictions and the other offices already. So, yeah, I think, you know, in different parts of Asia, which is the interesting part, right? When you apply the Western lens or the US, UK lens to Asia, it's always this big blob of place, you know, but this big blob of a region and everything's all the same. It's completely not. It's completely untrue. It's all different. You can't apply one lens to all of Asia. And you need to be extremely strategic about which markets within Asia you want to play into and what that looks like.
How as a comms, people who've got a career in comms who are looking at moving to Asia to continue and develop their career there, what advice would you give them about doing that?
Anyone that wants to come to Asia, I'd say go for it. You know, I genuinely think that it's such a dynamic region, and you could go literally from Hong Kong to Singapore 3.5 hours away. It's a completely different mentality, different mindset, different approach, different way of doing things. So it's interesting that you're asking that, because I recently spoke to a business development manager who is visiting secondment to Hong Kong, and he's very excited about it. And he was asking me about my views of him being based in Hong Kong temporarily and all of that. And I said, look, the thing is also in Asia, law firms see secondments or, you know, business development or partners being seconded to Asia all the time. You know, the first question we always ask is what are they going to offer us? From our point of view in Asia, it's always, oh, they're going to come here, get as much information as they can, and then they're going to bring it to the mothership.
Right.
But it serves us nothing. And so then, you know, partners or people working in Asia don't really feel the need to share all the information, particularly if it's a bit sensitive, particularly if you need to protect your clients or you want to, you know, gatekeep a little bit. If you want to come out to Asia, you've got to make sure that you have an open mind, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two is make sure there's a level of dedication in not that, oh, I'm just going to do this for a few months or a year, and then I'm going to go back home, because what you will learn is just a scratch on the surface.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's really, really, really good advice. I particularly like your advice about what are you bringing to us as opposed to what we give to you. Now, I'm conscious it's your career story we're focusing in on. We could go down a rabbit hole of the legal profession trends and everything else because you've got so much knowledge. But let's go back to you. I'm keen to know, this is a cheeky bit of a question, but if you were a front page news story, what do you think your headline would be?
Legal journalist had eggs thrown at her. Oh, if I was a... Genuinely, that's a good question. I don't know. If I was a front page story, I don't know. I never really thought about that. I think this is probably a time for people to think about asking me difficult questions, putting me on the spot. But I don't know is my answer, I guess.
Yeah. I don't like having eggs thrown at you. Do you think people? do you think there'd be a lot of people who would throw eggs at you?
You know what? I host our Asia Legal Awards for Law Dotcom International. And I always get a little bit nervous about who comes and the table that's closest to the podium.
You'll have to have your own bodyguard.
I joke about that as well. So when I'm hosting, I always tell people not to throw eggs at me. So,
what has surprised or delighted you about your career so far?
I have to say, when I was in-house, I really missed being a reporter. But when I was in-house, I was also very married to the idea that this was going to be it. Like, I was going to climb the corporate ladder in-house, and it was going to be the be-all and end-all of things, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, things happened, and you know, we were seconded to, as a family, we were seconded to London, and COVID happened. Had a baby, and so, you know, I had to make different choices, and a lot of Comet International super kind to have me back. It was such a breath of fresh air. I just felt like, you know, when you stay in-house for so, I stayed in-house for so long, and I felt like I was getting a bit tunnel visioned, or a bit of a, it felt a bit like, this sounds really bad to say, but a bit Stockholm syndrome, in that I felt like I just was so, yes, I work in the best law firm in the world. Yes, I have the best partners in the world. And yes, this law firm is great. And yes, and all of that. But you get so tunnel vision that you sort of lose track of the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And that was what I was really craving, finding that bigger picture and finding my voice in that bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And I think the delight in, disguised in difficult ways, when I had to leave law firms, it was that, yeah, you know, I now know so much more of what I know, and I have a voice, and I'm here to share that voice, and some people want to hear me out.
Yeah. I mean, I think you raise an interesting point, because I think if you do work for one firm, you often don't also have the time to be across what all the other firms are doing. Yeah. But in actual fact, in order to give the best advice internally, you sort of need to have that lens, don't you, on the perspective of what it is that your firm's doing compared to what the market is doing.
It's so important. I cannot stress this enough, right? And I admittedly lost this myself when I was in-house. It's so important to be curious. It's so important to ask questions. It's so important to question the answers that you're given. It's so important to question the motivations of an answer, of you know, something that moves the person that you're talking to. And, you know, like I said, you know, when I first started, I was told to not ask as many questions. And sometimes when you've been told that for so many years, you sort of, you know, you pedal, you toe the line, I suppose, right? But you know, people say there's no such thing as a stupid question. There are stupid questions, I can assure you that. And I ask stupid questions all the time. And sometimes you ask it to build rapport. Sometimes you ask stupid questions to test the salt of the person that you're talking to. Always ask questions. And I think, you know, having been in-house for a while, it's good to come back and ask the pointed questions.
What would you ask your younger self if you go back, thinking about when you took that huge leap to go to Sydney and start a course in journalism and PR, what would you be saying to that person now?
Best decision I ever made. You know, at that time, I was unsure. I was very unsure I know that I wanted to leave Singapore. I suppose my question was, my sort of issue was, I didn't know if I was going to make it. You know, or if I was just going to be one of those where, you know, you go to uni for a few years overseas and you come back home to Singapore. And I frankly left knowing that I wanted to be away for a while. Right. So I was very unsure. I was unsure if, you know, it was going to work, if my family's going to support me and all of that. And so looking back now, you know, all those concerns, totally, you know, this journey is totally worth it.
My final question for you, a lot of people read what you write. Who do you read?
Who do I read? Ooh.
What do you read? What books do you read, or what podcasts do you listen to, or what TED Talks would you recommend to listeners?
You're going to hate me. I don't listen to podcasts. But
yeah, but you'll listen to this one, surely.
Yes, of course, every day. strangely, I am a big fan of Louis Theroux. I also watch a lot of Stephen Bartlett. And I watch a lot of John Oliver. And also, I don't know if I want to expose this, but I also, you know, watch a lot of Jordan Peterson. And I think most of it stems from the fact, from me wanting to learn how to be more neutral.
Right.
wanting to be completely poker-faced in asking questions and being super calm in any difficult situation or in asking questions. And just, and even if being put in a super awkward conversation, be able to just be completely level with it. You will now know that I'm not that person. I'm fairly animated, and my husband will tell you if I'm unhappy or if I am not sold on what you're telling me, it's all over my face.
All over your face. Right.
So I think, you know, I follow those people because I try to learn to be a bit more neutral. And I've been like that in-house for a bit, but I'm also coming to terms with my way, my style.
Yeah, and it works for you.
I suppose to a certain extent, right? But there's always room for improvement.
Well, there's always room for improvement. But having interviewed you, I can say that, first of all, you're a brilliant interviewer. You've obviously had a lot of practice on the other side. And so it's nice to get to ask you the questions. You've given some great advice, which I'm really grateful for. And I'm sure some of our listeners will be as well. And I think you've exposed your nice, friendly personality to any of those people who think, I can't phone her because she might be scary. You've allayed all of those fears. You're not scary at all. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you this morning, and I'm really grateful for your time to come on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This is the only podcast I will ever do.
Oh, you heard it here first. Thank you so much, Jessica.
Thank you. Thanks, Graham.